Hey yo, what is a cipher?
That's what is what the beat told me to do. The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you. Where you think the cipher come from? The gods. Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 194, a talk with Boldy James. Boldy is a Detroit rapper who first came to many people's attention in 2009 after appearances on songs by his cousin Chuck English's group, The Cool Kids. But Boldy took that initial burst of interest and ran with it, releasing a slew of mixtapes and guest appearances leading up to his 2013 debut album, My First Chemistry Set, produced entirely by The Alchemist. We talked to Boldy a lot about his personal life, his interactions with the seedier side of Detroit, but also how he was strongly shaped by the influence of his father, a Detroit police officer. Boldy became a father himself at a relatively young age, a fact reflected in his rhymes. In addition, as you'll hear, he spent several of his key teenage years actually living down south and brought some of that region's music and trends back to his hometown. In 2014, Boldy was signed to Nas's then-new label, Mass Appeal Records. The rapper's latest project, out this past February, is House of Blues. We spoke to Boldy at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's the man who introduced Detroit to Boozy, Boldy James. I wanted to start out taking it back, actually, to a generation or two before you with Angelo Bond and the Bondage Review.
Okay.
So first off, given the name, did they wear bondage-themed costumes on stage?
No, their last names was Bond.
Right.
So, you know, I guess that was just a spin off the last name, my grandmother's last name.
Were they still performing by the time you were kids? I know they performed a lot in kind of the mid-70s.
I doubt it. I doubt if my grandma was still even into music other than like gospel at church.
Oh, okay.
By the time I came around.
Right. Did you ever hear any records from them or from Angelo? I know he wrote songs for a bunch of people.
In addition to the album he recorded under his own name, 1975's Bondage, Angelo wrote songs for The Main Ingredient, Frida Payne, The Silvers, Jermaine Jackson, The Temptations, and more.
I've made records from their old records.
Anything that's been released recently that we might...
One song is called Jackie Brown. And the other one is called Devil in Disguise. He saw heaven in her eyes. He knew hell was on the other side.
Lord, forgive me. But goddamn, she was fine on everything I love. Nice. And what was that like for you to kind of go back in your own, sample your own family history?
That's why I did it. So we'd be talking about this one day. Like, I had to do it. I felt like it was the first time I ever recorded over anything that had anything to do with my family.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, you know, I've rapped over so many other people's tracks and, you know, it just felt good to, you know, wrap up my own people's joint.
And there's music elsewhere in your family, right? Not just your grandmother and your uncle.
My grandfather, he used to play instruments. Like I say, my father, he used to like air play the drums, sit in the middle of the floor listening to jazz and shit.
Yeah.
My mom can sing, but she never does. But she can sing. Like I heard her sing a couple times. My auntie can sing. Of course, my grandmother.
So I know, obviously, you grew up in Detroit. And, you know, have the Detroit hat even on as we're speaking. But interestingly, you spent a lot of your really formative teenage years in small town Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So how did you end up there? Let's start there.
I was running with some kids that I got in trouble. It was a long situation, like a long list of things had happened. Like, that'd take up the whole session, probably me talking about that. But I end up, it was a court order that I go reform in Mississippi till I graduated from high school. So I just went down there and played the role like I was going to school. But really, I just went to Mississippi and learned, like, how it worked, you know, elsewhere, you know, somewhere else other than where I was from, rather.
Right. And what did you learn, though? How was it different than being in a big city like Detroit?
Way different. The houses is, you know, real far apart. You know what I'm saying? A lot of land in between each house or your neighbor. Might be half mile down the road. Huh. You know, that type of shit. You know, when I'm used to, you know, even if all the houses not on the street, like if it's a snag-a-tooth block where, you know, somebody done ran down certain houses on the block and you know how they tear down houses. So it'll be, it's supposed to be six houses in a row, but maybe it's one, five missing, then the sixth one. You know, I'm used to streets like that, you know what I mean? But still the neighbors not that far from each other. And then, you know, I got used to like the project life down in the South is different than the city boy project life. Mississippi taught me in so many words, I learned how to like smuggle and transport living in Mississippi. That's what Mississippi taught me, for real.
Yeah, interesting. And musically, what were you hearing there that people, when you would go back home for the summers and stuff, you would be up on that people wouldn't know about?
Lil Boosie. I put my whole neighborhood, like the whole Detroit city, I was the first nigga ever listening to Lil Boosie in Michigan. Because I had got a hold of some unreleased music, you know, on Biloxi, Mississippi, which was like not too far from Louisiana. So I got a hold of the CD and I was riding to it real hard. So when I went back to the crib, you know, for the summers or whatnot, in between my reform period, I was just putting my niggas in the hood up on the music. And, you know, now to see Boosie doing this thing on the level he's doing it on, I just had an argument with a cat named JR in jail about this same conversation we having about me putting the niggas in the hood up on Boosie. He telling me that he been up on Boosie and all that. So I had to ask him, what was the first song he ever heard? And the first song he ever heard was, you know, so far dated from the time that I got up on Boosie.
He said, even if you don't know it, you got it from me.
Yeah, for sure. It's just like the first time you seen somebody rock a pair of Gucci's. You know what I'm saying? You know, you wasn't the first one in the neighborhood to do it. You had to see somebody do it to get up on it to even want to do it. You know what I mean?
Right. So music for you, you started out when you were super young, you know, kindergarten, first grade even, making pause tapes. How did you get up on that?
Watching the older cats on my block do this shit, like my big homie Fitty, he used to make pause tapes. That's how I got up on it, just watching the older cats before me, how they dress, how they, you know, they style of music.
What were kind of your go-to records?
Like just old school Boney James music. Just a lot of jazz and blues because it didn't have a lot of words at times, so I could just, you know, loop some B.B. King shit, some Boney James, some, you know, the list goes on, all type of old school shit. Because my pops used to have a lot of records. My mom used to have a lot of tapes. So I used to record over their tapes and get in trouble for this shit. Like some of her favorite albums, I'm recording, you know, bullshit demo tapes and shit over her music. Thank God she, like, wasn't really listening to the shit we was rapping about then. If she probably did know my mother though and just didn't give a fuck, you know. But we was on some shit then.
And I know you early in your life were kind of on the east side of Detroit, and then once you got older, early teens or whatever, spent more time on the west side. For people who don't live there, what are the differences between those two sides of the city?
Big difference. East side was the first side, you know, built in the city. So then that means it's the first side that got ran down. Now they working on running the west side down, but times just different. Earlier, when I grew up till now in Detroit, it's like a whole lot of shit that's different from, you know, then to now. But for the most part, only thing different between West Side, East Side is West Side is a little bougier and like considered to be like more fashionable, but you know, it's wilder too. Cause it's like West Side, it's just, you can't really put your finger on why people are over there doing the things that they doing and getting into the shit they get into. I mean, it's all about the money at the end of the day, but it's just like, you know, you wonder what the motive is to why, you know, people are, you know, selling drugs and prostituting and, you know, all the shit people be into, you know, in that inner city, you know, underworld, you know, street life type of setting. Mm-hmm. Then East Side is looked at to be more grimy, more, you know, poverty, like more, more ghetto. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And they try to look down on East Side because the way people raised over there for the most part is like, not everybody didn't grow up poor, but it's just, it's the grand side of town. Like everybody grow up hustling, they mothers, you know, grow up junkies and, you know, you end up serving your mom's type shit like growing up, like your daddy be one of your number one customers, but it's your father type situation, you know?
Yeah.
And not to say it doesn't happen on both sides of towns. It's just, it's more like that on the East Side. It's just more, it's good for people that's from that underworld setting, but people that's not from that, it's like a step down from, you know, the way they see life, like coming from the West Side. Most West Siders I know prefer not to come to the East Side. Mm-hmm. And then most East Side cats I know, they'll travel westward, but they really be stuck in their bubble too, and they don't really like to come outside their bubble. So I try to get both sides to mix and mingle, and it's hard at times because it's so different. You know what I mean? Even though it's still the city of Detroit, it's like Baltimore and Philadelphia. You know what I mean? Like, it's all East Coast, but it's so different. You know what I mean? That's Detroit in a nutshell.
Yeah, yeah. And so while you're growing up in Detroit and in Mississippi, you're seeing a lot of what you call kind of underworld stuff. But your father's a cop. It's kind of a weird tension there all the time.
All my uncles was gangsters and my daddy, he just was a different type of nigga. Like I was raised like on some mafia shit, like a whole bunch of guns, all my daddy best friends, they all them niggas gangsters and shit. Like I remember growing up, like dry fire in a house full of pistols. Like it'd be just as many people as it is as us in the room, and they all got big ass, pretty ass guns and shit, like all new guns and shit, and they all sitting there. Little Mooch, come in here, come in the kitchen real quick. I walk in the kitchen, you know, bunch of money, liquor, you know what I'm saying? Niggas with suits and dives and trench coats and furs and shit on and shit, you know, and they all, putting their gun in my hands with me between their arms, teaching me how to shoot guns and shit. So, you know, I grow up getting in trouble and shit. And my dad always told me, he always seen it coming. He just tried to get me to understand why he was on my head about the things that he was. And then there were certain things he knew he wasn't going to be able to control because I'm a boy. I'm from Detroit. You know what I'm saying? Growing up at the time, then I'm going to be a man one day and I'm going to have to think for myself. So he gave me a lot of guidance. Like I had a great father. You know what I'm saying? My father been there every day of my life. I ain't one of them cats that can say, like, you know, my dad wasn't there and used that for no excuse or no shit. Like, just like my son, like, me and my son got a great relationship. You know what I'm saying? Me and my dad, as well as my stepsons, like, I got great relationships with my sons.
Yeah. But there was a point at which you, as I understand it, and you correct me if I'm wrong, took one of your dad's guns and ran away from home.
Yeah, I ran away from home.
How old
at
were you?
11. At 11 years old, and I never went back. That's just what type of kid I was.
Oh. Like, but stayed in the general neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, not really. I was out of town, all that type of shit. Like, I was a different type of kid. Like, anybody who know me will tell you, like, I just always been on the shit I've been on. Like, when I got my mind set on something, I'm going to do it, you know? Like, no matter how much trouble I get in at the end of the day or consequences, repercussions, like, when I'm locked in, I'm locked in. And I've just been like that since a kid. Like, I ran away at 11, and the only time I would come home is when, you know, I would go to the youth home and it'd be a court order that I got to go home or I got to tether or, you know, things of that nature. And then soon I used to cut my tethers off, run away, this all type of shit. Like, I just was a different type of kid. Like, you know, I didn't mean to be as mischievous as I was, but my friends were so much older. You know, my cousins were so not gang-orientated type of madness, but, like, just hustle-orientated, like, street life affiliated. So, you know, I've been seeing drugs and violence and fast-tail women and, you know, hot rods and nice cars and, you know, just people make something out of nothing. You know what I'm saying? I've been seeing that shit my whole life. So that's just the nature of the beast now. Like, I just try to pick my battles wisely. That's all.
Yeah. And Mooch or Moochie was your childhood nickname.
Yep, little,
where'd that come
little
from?
Lil Moochie. My father's name is Moochie as well. So my grandmother gave him that nickname when he was little. It was a character off of the Disney Channel back in the day.
Oh, Moochie, is it true about Wilby?
They just call him Moochie, you know what I'm saying? So I was Lil Moochie. I'm my father's only son, so, you know, the name, it stopped with me, though. I don't call my son...
Lil Moochie?
Littler Moochie.
Littler Moochie.
But he'd call himself Lil Moochie sometimes, just being silly, like, but his nickname, Bojay.
Bojay.
Yeah, for Bodie James. Like, he the real Bodie James. Like, it's all... My real name is James, you know what I'm saying? Y'all all know where I got the name Bodie from. But he, my sisters and all of them, he has adopted, like, he's the real Bodie James, so they call him Bojay.
Oh, okay.
You know, so that's his nickname.
Tell me about the original Boldy James, the one you took your name from, who's in your neighborhood. What was he like?
It's like like I told Jack Thriller, it's like the 50 Cent Boo Boo story.
The rapper 50 Cent, whose nickname even to this day among close friends is Boo Boo, took his rap name in tribute to the notorious Brooklyn stick-up kid, Kelvin 50 Cent Martin. You can hear more about the original 50 Cent in episode 190 with Paradise Gray.
It's like, my across-the-street neighbor. Maybe been like five, six years older than me at the time. But you know, when you're younger, that make all the difference in the world, you know? So I grew up watching him, you know, maturing from a regular little boy on the block, building on motorbikes and stealing scooters and shit, to hustling up his first cars, to, you know, now he really playing with some chips. And, you know, we all know how he got the money. Like, my father used to, like, tell him certain things to do, not to draw attention to police. Like, my dad was always, like, the mentor to all the kids in the neighborhood, you know what I mean? But all my friends thought my daddy was the coolest nigga in the world. I just thought he wasn't cool because he was my father. But Bodie used to love my father, you know, and Bodie used to pay me to stash drugs in my house because my father was the police. So I used to pinch out Bodie Peck, and that's how I started selling cocaine, you know. But Bodie was just one of my role models growing up, you know what I mean? So him not rapping and me and him having the same name and him, you know, raising me from a youngin, I just adopted the name, you know what I'm saying? And before he died, he knew, he gave me permission to use the name. So, you know, it just meant that much more when he got murdered, because, you know, shit, now he lived through me and my music. But I ended up growing up finding out what happened about this shit, you know, when he got murdered. So, shit just crazy around my way, you know?
Yeah. So probably about 10 years ago now, your cousin's group, the Cool Kids, starts getting a lot of attention. Really, you know, blowing up. People start talking about them.
Hold the phone like a call on the other line. The Cool Kids are a rap duo made up of Boldy's cousin, Evan Ingersoll, a.k.a. Chuck English, and Antoine Sir Michael Rocks Reed. They started garnering major attention around 2007.
What was that like for you to see at that point? Because I know you were rapping, but you hadn't made any records at that point.
I never once seen that coming. I didn't know Chuck was as serious about his music as he was at the time. So once I seen that happening, it was shocking at first. But then once I realized what was going on, I was proud of him. Like, you know, I never once hated on Chuck. I just didn't understand when he was telling me at the time that it don't matter how in position he was at the time musically, no matter how bad I wanted it at the time, I had to get it myself. He couldn't do it for me. I didn't understand that at the time, you know.
You thought, well, he's on. People are talking about him. Why can't he just...
Nah, I never looked at it like that because he's still my little cousin. Like, just being a man, you know what I'm saying? That's just the way I am. Like, I try not to take no handouts or, you know, try to put myself in a position or always have to owe people tenfold and all that shit. So, you know, I wanted to work for it, for my spot. Of course, you know, but Chuck, I just felt like it was more he could have been involved with personally when it came to doing my music and not always had to be so involved in the records that I'm making. Like, you don't, you shouldn't have to produce the record that I'm making to want to have something to do with the moves being made behind the scenes. If you want to see me win, put me in position. And I didn't know that. That's what he was doing from get-go. I didn't understand how this music shit really worked. Mm-hmm. And Chuck was my tour guide through my first steps and first stages of the, you know what I'm saying, this industry shit.
Yeah. Well, your first, I think your first appearance on a record was on that Don Cannon Cool Kids tape, right?
Yep, the first record that was ever.
It was a barbecue.
Barbecue wing. Just a smuggler's bam, tell him ketchup, mustard, peanut butter, butter, pecan, vanilla, and custard. Dress on recruit,
salute, general custard, clusters, iced out, eyebrows, blush, and Tuscan. I think one other one on that tape.
Tire. Bubble bag window tinted, cherry red SS kitty with the European clip and the halogen headlamps,
iridescent tail lights, turbo blue dripping out the tailpipes. When you listen back to those verses now, what do you hear?
I hear a young man, like, who was hungry and didn't know, like, what direction he wanted to take his music in. To me, like, having a stage and a plateau to, like, get my music heard from. And now not to know, not to even know what to do with this shit. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even know. I just try to make the best music I can make and make sure it sit all right with me first. And then I guess I'll be good with putting it out to the rest of the world. But it's hard to appease myself musically because I've been doing this shit for so long. It don't never seem like I'm topping the last song I did. Sometimes it's like a cap off point. Like I can only, it's like smoking weed. I can only get so high before I'm just coasting and I'm just, you feel me? Before I'm just floating at a certain height, you know what I mean? That only can only get so high.
Yeah. Now, when you listen back to that stuff, like I said, 2009, 2010, some of your guest appearances around that time, what's changed in terms of your writing, in terms of your style or delivery from then to now?
I didn't even used to do it on purpose. I just had a slow flow. Put on my C frames, turn on my mini phone, cut on my next tail, threw my D fitting on. They call me King James Jones, it's written stone. All my concrete is getting it on in the zone. But I was able to say every word in my rap when I perform it because it wasn't so wordy. Now, thank God I quit smoking cigarettes and shit because I can breathe a little bit better now. But it's hard to enunciate. I mean, it's hard to say all that shit on the stage while you're performing without a hype man or without some type of studio tricks on your show tapes. You know what I mean? Or the show mixes, rather. And
so there's just more words now in your verses.
Some of them. You know what I'm saying? Like, my songs are more wordy than they used to be. Tony Parker with them 9 pieces in the foreign with a sovereign citizen from overseas. Extra charge. Told him if I pay for 2, you front me 3. Now that's a bargain. Carbon 15. I guess it's like my topic of discussion has changed because my life is so different now than it was then because, you know, now I got a family. Now, you know, like, it's shit more important going on with me than just me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I was surprised to find out, just given your style and stuff, that Master P was a big influence, not even in terms of how he sounded, but in terms of his subject matter, that he was talking about stuff you thought, like, very true to him, and that kind of pushed you towards being true to yourself. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I grew up with a whole bunch of wild niggas. So I might have been the most civilized out of all the people I came up with. But I was the only one who had a father. No, I'm not going to say that. Because I had some wild niggas who had a father. All my niggas Bird and, you know, R.I.P. Tay Frankie and my nigga Leslie. They had father. They father was named Buster. But they was some wild niggas, though. And they put me up on Master P. Like, that's all they used to listen to. So even though that wasn't how I would come off being from Detroit, and I, you know, we viewed as like big city boys. So I would never adopt that style, you know what I mean? But the subject matter I could relate to because, you know, we was drug dealing, robbing, getting high and shit. Some of my niggas was smoking wet. You know, niggas was popping scalenes and it just, they was just into some different shit, you know. So when they, you know, you hear Master P talking about some gone off that water water.
You better not fuck with them fools that's gone on that water water.
And I didn't even know what that shit meant back then until, you know, I started thinking about it like, damn, my niggas be dipping cigarettes and shit and bombing fluid. And they, you know, they smoking sherm. That's wet, wet. So when he say he gone off that water, mm-hmm. That's what he talking about, you know. So I'm just tripping off shit, being grown, you know, being able to identify like what was really going on, and you know, now I can hear the music, and it ain't too far off from this shit these niggas rap about now. Like they want to be country boys now. They want to, you know, rock Versace silks and, you know what I'm saying, Cartier glasses and Rolex watches. Like P been doing all that shit.
Yeah,
P been riding Benzes and. You know, his regular day, you know, it'd be like some niggas, like life goals and shit, you know what I mean? And that probably ain't even where he feel like he has so much further to go in life. You feel me? He might only have $10 million at the time. But now being a couple hundred millionaire and shit like that, like, no, that's what I always seen in P, that he was gonna win regardless. Like, no matter if you fucked with his music or not, he was gonna make it work for him.
And, you know, you talked about wet and, you know, it makes me think of slang. And you have that, your record Moochie, which at least the first verse of it is kind of in that tradition of Ebonics, of the Big L record of breaking down slang. But for you, your version of it seemed to be like a very personal slang, maybe just stuff that you used or people in your neighborhood used.
A tooth is a split, a baby is a stewie, a kilo is a brick, a quarter is a cutie. If you're telling you a snitch, county is the Skadooski, a sentence is a bit, the prison is the hoopski, a shooter is a goonie, blink is a whole clip on some motion picture shit, take you to see a movie.
What was behind that record?
Just to have fun with it, you know what I mean? I didn't even mean for it to turn out into that. It just started off like I heard the beat. You know, that's what the beat told me to do, you know?
All that slang, was that stuff you made up or stuff you heard around or what?
I make up everything niggas say in my neighborhood for the most part. Like 70-80% of how niggas talk around my way, they get that shit from me. Mm-hmm. All they nicknames, all they, you know, all the nicknames for the neighborhoods, the blocks, like all that shit. The way they talk, period. They get, like I say, I'm the E-40 of my city.
Mm-hmm. And one other influence musically that I wanted to talk to you about for a second is Jay, because you quote him on a couple songs, including I Sold Dope All My Life and a few others.
I put your crew in hard bottoms. The priest is like God's got him. He never did nothing and nobody but them boys shot him. Brandon Cheyenne. And my mans, then I lost Swally. He never did shit to nobody but them boys shot him. We hold court.
As an artist, as a rapper, and like as a personality, what did Jay-Z mean to you when you were starting out?
My man Frankie, he got found in a trash can with his dick in his mouth. He was a wild boy, Frankie, you know, done robbed and killed half the fucking city, you feel me? And growing up, this was once again like another one of my role models. He had a Reasonable Doubt CD. I didn't even know what the CD was. I just seen the CD with the 2.5 on it. It was a 2.5 pistol on the cover of the, you know, on the front of the CD artwork. I stole the CD. Put it in my underwear, like on the bridge of my underwear. And I sat there and chilled with the guys for probably like an hour with the CD on me. Walked it around the corner because I was still, you know, running away from home at the time. So I walked the CD around the corner to my homeboy's Brent house, who's no longer here. He passed away too. But I go over Brent house. He had a single mom. She was always at work. So We was at his crib basically doing whatever the fuck we wanted to do. And they had this real nice stereo system in the basement. So I put the CD on. I cut the radio up loud as it can go because nobody was there. Brent wasn't even at the house at the time. His mom was gone. I used to have keys to the house. I used to damn like live there, you know. So I put the CD on and I'm feeling all of the shit. But then they get to this song on there called Coming to Age. So when I hear him and Bleak on the song, it reminded me of me and Frankie, the nigga who I stole the CD from.
Hey fella, I've been watching you clock.
Who me holding down this block? It ain't nothing. You the man, nigga. Now stop fronting.
I like your style.
Nah, I like your style.
Let's drive around the world.
Cool, nigga.
Here's a thot.
A G, I ride with you for free.
I damn near can't even tell him that I'm up on this song because
it's his CD.
Yeah. But what's so crazy about it is I was over there one day and he really was losing it about this CD, like. Like, man, I could have swore, like, I set the CD here, dog. Niggas always stealing shit out of my shit. And I'm sitting there like, yeah, man, you think it was such and such and such and such, you know? So, fucking with them niggas, it just taught me how to be a criminal, you know? Then it put me up on so much good music, because them the niggas who put me up on Nas, them the niggas who, you know, was just putting me up on all the new niggas that was hot and, you know, that was, you know, on the verge of making it big in music. You know, down the line. So being that I look up 20 years down the line and these are all the people that's in position to call shots and pull strings, I know that I just got great taste in music because none of the people in my neighborhood liked the music that I was listening to. It was all about like West Coast Bad Boys, C-Bo, you know, of course Scarface was burning shit up. You know, Dre and N.W.A., all of them had shit on lock. And then, you know, you got these niggas coming out the East, to me, they just was the most unique at the time. Like, the shit that they was on, it just seemed like to me that it was going to stand the test of time. And, you know, my decisiveness didn't fail me.
Yeah. And, you know, now, in fact, and we'll get to, obviously, the stuff with Nas in a minute, but you're working with a lot of these people now. You've done songs with Prodigy.
Right.
I get along with these niggas. Maybe something wrong with me. I trust none of these niggas. They all out to get me.
You have a song on the new project with G-Rap, which was incredible. What was that like, working with G-Rap?
Butter, you know what I'm saying, got a relationship with G-Rap. So G-Rap was down to do the record. You know what I mean? To be able to work with P, you know, go on tour with Mobb Deep, you know, perform on the same stage as Nas, have records with AZ, Ghostface, Killer.
Right, that's on the Rubble King soundtrack, your record with
right,
Killer.
Like,
yeah.
Come together like Bible study, the plot, the plan, the conquer, just to get money, just to get money, just to get money, just to get money.
I got a record with Votto and Aldo. Who else I didn't work with? You get what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
All the people I grew up listening to do records with them now, it's like, it's more than a dream come true, but it's just, I could just see this shit working now, you know what I mean? I see my music is changing my life, you know what I mean? It's like right in front of my eyes, my life is changing because, you know, these people used to seem like superheroes to me growing up, you know? Now to meet them in person, it's like, now certain people look at me as a superhero. Crazy to me.
So the cover of The Art of Rock Climbing, right, has a bunch of sort of Detroit hip-hop figures as the faces of Mount Rushmore and you and DJ Butter climbing it. One of the people I actually hadn't heard of, and I was hoping maybe you could fill me in on who he was and why he was important, and it's Blade Icewood.
He was just Detroit's. He was the people's champ, you know? He was a nigga from my neighborhood, 7 Mile, you know, over there, like, off the west side block, so I grew up. He was just, like, the most respected street rapper, you know what I'm saying, that's ever come through Detroit since, like, Esham. Or like, really had never been no nigga to just come through and fuck the city up like that. Like, he just had the city. He wasn't even the best rapper. It was just like his image matched his music.
No one above me, the streets love me, though the struggle nearly took me under. Your dog still bored every summer. Brother got knocked, Rick got knocked, I'm still well stocked, copping up the blood every block, the whole 7 Mile road, dog, east back west. Ripped up 30 Gucci purses for the seats in the vet. I'm just
so Detroit felt like he should be the spokesperson for the city, but he ended up getting paralyzed. And then, you know, the second go around, he got murdered before he was able to, you know, make it out off the music.
The doctor say I never walk again. That's fucked up with them niggas that shot me up. They mans will never talk again, speak again.
In September 2004, Blade was shot 7 times with an AK-47 while in his house. He was left paralyzed from the waist down. The following April, he was shot and killed while at a car wash on the west side of Detroit.
And you mentioned Isham a second ago. Were you a fan of his?
Yes, definitely.
How did people react to him? Because he was obviously pretty over the top.
Fucking nuts with the devil worship and shit.
Wait to meet the grim reaper creature feature. Isham the unholy Satan was my teacher. And fuck the preacher, I'm gonna kill him when I catch him. Put your body in the coffin and stretch him. Close casket.
Isham is a Detroit rapper who refers to his style as acid rap, comparing his lyrics to drug-induced hallucinations. His most common themes are death, drug use, evil, and yes, even Satan.
I just always looked at it as music. I never looked at it like that was the real him. Mm-hmm. You know, people was rapping about a whole bunch of crazy shit at the time. And like, people was getting so high, you know, that the music was getting darker, you know. And I just feel like when people get to making music like that, it's because music is like heading in that direction. And they just try to be as creative as they can be, but they just take it too far sometimes.
Right. He really.
Yeah, that's just in my opinion.
Yeah. One thing I noticed listening back through your catalog to prepare for this, the image of a blue moon comes up on more than one of your songs.
You can see the lights from the new moon once every blue moon.
Is there something about that image that you like that you keep coming back to it?
It's because this House of Blues was about pills. You know what I'm saying? It was about selling pills, you know what I'm saying? But not, the music wasn't all about selling pills, just the imagery of it, like, because pills are very relevant right now, you know what I'm saying? Because it's consistent, like, you know what you're getting. When you, especially like heroin-based pills, because when you get a pack of heroin from somebody, it's not consistent all the time. Like, you get different shit, like, people cut the shit with different shit, people got different mixes to their formulas. But a pill, you know, it's regulation. It's the same dose, the same thing every time. So you actually know what you're buying. You know what, how much bang you getting for your buck, you know? Niggas don't even give a fuck about having a scale no more because they sell so many pills. Like, niggas still sell vampire drugs, but the pills is taking over. So it's just about me keeping up with the sign of the times. But I'm from the street, so I always try to keep that edge on my music, you know? That's all that's about. Like, the moon, I'm a night owl. So the most of my day is dark. Like, the most of the part of the day I see is the darker part of the day. Like, my wife is sleepy head. She always on my head about me ripping, running the street so much. Because she feel like those the times that, you know, I can get into the most trouble to put not only my life in jeopardy, but my family, my relationship, all that shit as well, you know. So me being, you know, ex-drug dealer and that being the part of the night where I make most of my money or, you know, different type of hustles come out at those times of the night, you know, like the late night gambling hours, of course, the prostitution, the clubs, the after-hour scene, you know, then them studio sessions, and, you know, like all that shit make her think nothing but the worst, you know. But I might make $1,000 while she's sleeping. You feel me? And times where, you know, the day, then, you know, the height of the day where everybody is up and everybody hustling and, you know, everybody ripping and running and trying to catch that rush, I'm not as needed as I am in them nighttime hours, you know? And I just, like I said, I've just always been a night owl. So that's just in, you know, that's what that represents.
Mm-hmm. And your wife wouldn't even listen to your music for a long time, right? Because of some of those tensions you're talking about.
Not that she wouldn't listen to it, because she really didn't have a choice. She was around a lot of times when I'm making the music, you know, falling asleep in the studio sessions, bored out her mind. All that shit.
You
know?
Can be pretty boring if you're not doing anything.
I mean, if you're not into music or you don't rap and you into other shit, of course this is boring to you, you know? But it's my life, you know what I'm saying? And at the time, the shit I was going through, it just had my music just so dark that used to tell me, like, damn, this song is so depressing, like, it makes me want to jump off a bridge, you know? And we were just going through so much crazy shit at the time that, you know, maybe just, you know, you just don't want to hear that type of shit when your mind is already in the dumps, you know?
Was there any particular song of yours you remember that she really, that she found super depressing?
A song called Abortion that I had is to talk about. I referenced the Biggie song where he said, you know, his mama wish she had a fucking abortion. Mm-hmm. I made a hook out of that line, and it was just called Mommy Dearest.
Crime after crime, from drugs to extortion. I know my mother wish she got a fucking abortion.
This, of course, is the Biggie track Suicidal Thoughts from Ready to Die that Boldy sampled for Mommy Dearest. Unfortunately, Mommy Dearest doesn't appear to be anywhere online, and because Boldy's out on tour, he was unable to get us the track in time for the release of this episode.
The song is just dark. My man Sterling Toes, he produced it, and he used to always tell me to be more personal. So the more personal I got, the darker my music got. And then people had to, like, bring me back to the light and start telling me, like, why don't you try to have fun and party more with your music and all that shit. So that's where we at with it now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which brings me to the new project, which actually musically is very different than The Art of Rock Climbing, very different than your first album. It's a lot more sort of the moment sounding, a lot more kind of trap sounding.
Caught the nigga Dexin' in Tesla, but we sent a message. Bully boys, we apply pressure for an intermission. You got a pitchfork on the grill like Maserati Ring. In Detroit, bitch, I'm the real like Maserati Ring. Behind the wheel, I feel like Maserati.
Why go that direction?
Because people always tell me I'm the only person that never sounds out of place on records with people that you wouldn't expect me to do songs with. Meaning, like, it's this kid around the way named Evan the Twerk Guy.
Yeah. I'm a no one's ever kind. Picked up a Malibu body. I did some flexing with X. Aaron Bonus in my name.
And to me, he makes cool ass music, you know, but me listening to motherfuckers, a motherfucker might tell me something like, and you doing a song with him is going to tarnish your image or whatnot. And I'd be like, how? When Gucci Mane do songs with Ray Sherman, or, you know, Meek Mill do a song with a nigga like Kirko. You know what I'm saying? Like, how? You know what I'm saying? Good music is good music. And if a person true to self, then I'm all right with that. You know what I mean? Person ain't having an identity crisis and shit. I'm cool with that. So I just be trying to meet people in the middle. Like, I like hip hop more so than I like the trap rap shit. So I try to trap hop my music, you know. Try not to never take away from, you know, my big city boy Detroit, you know, image that I want to bring to the world all the time. It's just, I got to switch it up, and I never want my music to sound the same. Like, that's what you got to penalize some of the greats for. Like a lot of them was really scared to step out their lane, you know? And when they did step out their lane, people questioned whether or not they was falling off. So I go through that shit too, you know? Like, people will hear some different shit from me and be like, yo, I ain't really fucking with that shit. That ain't the Boldy James I know. And stick to the shit you did on the Alchemist joint. Then I hear another motherfucker telling me, like, yo, man, that music too slow, man. You need to speed it up. Niggas is in the club with this shit now. And I try to make a club song, and a motherfucker will tell me, like, yo, what's up with that you and Chuck English Jimbo type of shit you was making, man?
I got some niggas doing biz over 100 plus. Plus, I shot a nigga as a kid for 100 bucks.
Throw your sevens high, or your six is low. If you for 7 Mile, or man equals roll.
But, like, you need to get back to that shit, man. And so, you know, I just try to switch it up so I got something for everybody. So it get to a point where a motherfucker finally realized, like, damn, you know, Bo-J might have had the most versatility when it came to, you know, him not really having to step that far outside of his comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. The new album has the song Jew.
Came up on the jug, always up to no good. Stay switching my phone number, stay in touch with my plug.
What is the jug?
Jug is like anything that got something to do with, like, turning a dollar over. You know, any flip you can make, any lick you can hit, any finesse move, you know, you can get down on a nigga with. Like, it's all jug, you know. So my homeboy Go Grizzly, who produced You know, a lot of the tracks on House of Blues, you know, he got artists he worked with in Atlanta. And, you know, it's that party scene. So we had come up with records to where it got that bounce to it, but I get to put my twist on the record, you know, and it's still being, you know, me still being cool with the sound, like me stepping outside of my, outside of that box that I'm in all the time musically, but still not feeling uncomfortable with being outside the box.
And I saw just the other day on Twitter, you announced you're signing artists to your own label. Yeah. So what's that about?
My little homeboy Rez, he been, you know, in connection with me for a long time now. Through just people I know in the streets and people like, you know, I they had other prior business ventures with and shit. So he cussed into me one day and tell me that he will pay me to sign him.
It's a pretty good deal.
So I'm like, I mean, you know, it depends on what he want, what he, you know, what he's looking for me to be able to do for him as well, though, because it still got to be within reason, because I'm not into just fucking people over royally or no shit like that, you know? So he a good kid, you know? Good young nigga, you know? So I like keeping good people around me. So I just started noticing that he was serious about his music, you know? He got the hustle in him. He young, so his subject matters and his content, like he got that new era shit, you know? So I just got to mold him into knowing how to be just versatile with the shit. Just let them know, like, not to, you know, be one-track-minded with the music. And I could see the kid really going places. Like, it's just like how Sean cut into Kanye.
Mm-hmm.
That's damn near how Lil Dog cut into me. Like he feel like, he, you know, he confident enough to just feel like he got what it take to take it to the next level. And since I've got to know him and I've learned his music better, I believe in the kid. You know?
Yeah. And so you're wearing a Mass Appeal sweatshirt, so it seems like a good time to ask you about the label. So you once said, I was doper when I didn't care as much what people thought about the music.
Right.
And now you're in a situation where you're associated with perhaps, you know, the highest profile rapper and his new label and all the attention that comes with that. How are you dealing with that?
I'm dealing with it, you know. It ain't no big deal for real. Like, it's not as much pressure as shit I go through on a day-to-day. So it's a learning experience. It's, it didn't do nothing but better my career, if you ask me, because I get so many good looks just being affiliated to the brand, you know? Mass Appeal always, they always make sure, like, I'm involved in everything that I feel like I should be involved in. And you notice the label growing, getting stronger, making different moves. And then, like, I'm just getting back to work for real after 2 years. You know, I'm just starting to put music out again, so.
Right, you had the Art of Rock Climbing was kind of interrupted midway through, and you had some management issues and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, in one sense, you've made it about as far as, you know, anyone could think when they start out rapping, right? You've got signed by perhaps your favorite artist.
Right. That's exactly what
happened. Right. So what's next? Can you see past this point?
That's the problem. Like, I only plan to get here. Like, now I'm making the plan. Now that I'm here, I got to come up with a plan to make sure I stay here.
Right. Took 20 years of planning and work to get here.
Right.
What are sort of your preliminary thoughts about next steps?
I don't know. Maybe one day, possibly, you know, doing what Jay did with The Rock or what Nas doing with Mass Appeal. Like, mm-hmm. I want to be the one to write the checks.
You know, one or two final things. On one of your earliest songs with the Cool Kids on Roll Call, you shout out a Michigan institution, the Fab Five.
Team Wolverine, U of M, Hirachis. They call me Jimmy King of the concrete.
The 1991 University of Michigan men's basketball recruiting class, Chris Webber, Jalen Rose, Juwan Howard, Jimmy King, and Ray Jackson, is considered to be one of the greatest of all time and came to be known as the Fab Five. The teammates had great success on the court and controversy off of it. Most of their wins in both their Final Four appearances were vacated due to some players accepting money from Michigan booster Ed Martin. In recent years, there have been efforts to rehabilitate the image of the Fab Five, including a public forum at Michigan in October of 2016. We'll have a link to photos of the Fab Five wearing their patented Nike Air Huaraches in the show notes to this episode.
Can you tell me about the Fab Five, what they meant to you growing up in Detroit? I know Detroit and Ann Arbor, not that far apart.
I was a big U of M fan. You know, of course, the Jalen Rose, Chris Webber, Juwan Howard, Jimmy King, Ray Jackson, you know, Fab Five swag, you know. But I had four best friends growing up. It was me, my boy Jermaine, my homeboy Bird, my man Jimmy, and my homeboy Lee. We used to call ourselves the Fab Five. I was really the only one out of us that played basketball, you know. But just what we came up with, because there was five of us. And that's what that was in reference to, because I used to love those Huaraches. Remember when they had the Huaraches on that didn't even match their outfit with the big, when they came with the big basketball shorts, big droopy Michigan shorts and shit with the white, purple, and black Huaraches on, you know? That was one of my favorite times in basketball, because that was just some ill shit to do, how the shoes didn't have nothing to do with the color scheme of the U of M Wolverines theme, you know? So me just making reference to that, I just always try to keep it as Michigan as I can keep it, you know, because that's the state I'm from. I just try to keep it as Detroit as I can keep it, because that's the city that raised me. So little shit like that, just be showing appreciation to my city, but, you know, it'd be letting people know I know how to rap and put together, like, metaphors and shit too, you know? Because I try to do it slick without always having to say, like, so much, or, you know, because there's only so many ways to do the punchline shit.
I was going
to
say, you're not really a punchline rapper.
That's
that
on
sense.
Purpose, though.
That is. That's something you avoid on purpose. Why?
Because I only like that shit with the battle rappers and shit. Like, I don't think people should have a song full of that shit. Mm-hmm. I think of so many other ways to word like.
Yes. And I know, wrap up, I know you are going way back to Jordan 2s, a giant sneakerhead. First off, what do you have on now?
Fives.
Are those original, reissue?
Nah, these some reissue, low top, fives. You see the sole different on them. I actually got these from my son. He wanted these black Jordans that I had. I think they was some 13s. Mm-hmm. They was like these new edition 13s where they like reflector. It's kind of shiny. And I had a bad incident with running from the police where my soles was glowing in the dark on my shoes, and I had to kick my shoes off in somebody's backyard. And I had to run the rest of the way barefoot. And I just got to think about the shiny, anything shiny other than some jewelry. He actually liked the shoes, so he traded me a pair of fives for the 13s.
And is there a pair of shoes that's your holy grail that you've wanted but don't have yet?
Nah, only I got so many pairs of sneakers. Like, that ain't even my thing no more. Like, I'm into, like, other shit, and I like Jimmy Choo's. Shit like that, you know? I like Gucci's. Like Louis Vuitton sneakers. As far as Jordans and Barclays and Pennies and, you know, Chris Webbers and, you know, the Jason Kidd's and Latrell Sprewell's or Kobe Bryant's, David Robinson's. I got, the list goes on with them kicks. Tim Hardaway's, like, all the classic shit. I got all the shit that I couldn't get when I was little and I wanted it. I had to sit there and get tortured watching it on another nigga feet, or me knowing I can dress better than niggas and just couldn't afford the shit that I was into back then, like shit like that. Like, I got all that shit now. So I'm past that, you know what I mean? Like, the sneaker shit, I ain't on that. I like to just be comfortable now and know that I got the money in my pocket to buy whatever I want. Like, I'm into that now.
And, you know, now that House of Blues is out, what should we be on the lookout for coming up next from Boldy Dan?
Pillmatic.
Pillmatic? You are going to use that title for something?
Yeah, I think I'm about to drop Pillmatic. If God's son blessed me with the
if you get the
green light,
name.
Yeah. I'm dropping Pillmatic. And hopefully he'll be, like, more involved in this CD, because I'm about to clock in on this one. I got a whole bunch of raps and shit I've been writing. And a whole bunch of new shit I've been trying out on these records. So I'm going to just experiment with that on this one. And then I didn't know if I was going to wait in between Pillmatic and House of Blues to drop a new Alchemist tape because I wanted to work on another Alchemist joint. I will tell you the title of that, but I don't want nobody to steal it before I get to drop it.
Okay, but that is in the works.
I don't think nobody can steal this, even if I was to tell them.
What is it?
My man Box, he called me Salzar in the neighborhood. You know, he just be being silly. He always come up with these crazy, me and him give each other crazy names. Like I call him M-Box. I call him M-Box Audemars, and he called me Salzar. So I was looking at the Alka-Seltzer thing. And it just was, that's what it was, like Alka and Salzar. So it was Alka-Seltzer.
Oh.
You know what I'm saying? So I was going to drop Alka-Seltzer. That was going to be my next Alchemist project.
Nice. Well, we look forward to it. Boldy James, thanks for coming by.
Right, anytime. I appreciate y'all.
Not often that I sit down for an interview and it goes to totally unexpected places, but Boldy James brought so much detail and precision to his tales of growing up in Detroit and down south, the same detail and precision that he brings to rapping about those topics, that I continued down that road far more than I expected. But the interview also doesn't hurt for details about his music, from his dislike of punchlines to his insight into why House of Blues sounds the way it does and how it got its title. There's enough here to put Boldy's catalog in a whole different light. Join us next week when our guest will be Bill Stefney. Bill was a key member of Public Enemy's Brain Trust. He was Def Jam's very first employee. He was the president of his own label and a whole lot more. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Once you do that, you'll also be able to listen to our back catalog. If you enjoyed this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another one-of-a-kind Detroit-affiliated rapper, Quelle Chris, on episode 141. If you use iTunes, it's incredibly important to give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. Also consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every single week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh. And we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share bonus material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. Become a patron by the end of March to get access to April's file. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotaro.
I can only get so high before I'm just coasting.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I might have been the most civilized out of all the people I came up with.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
He was the people's champ.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
He got found in a trash can with his dick in his mouth.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Francisco Garcia.
It's all about the money at the end of the day.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Dog really is in love with me. Don't be ashamed. Oscar, everybody act like that over me.